Okay, so the homework 3 is due today, right? So you're going to give it to me, and then remember to pick up your project 2 that was actually graded the last class, but I wanted to look at them once, and I have them now, so you can make sure that you can pick them up before you leave. And so are there any questions before we get started? Okay, so we are now into the third part of the course. Essentially, this part is mostly a collection of topics that are best understood in terms of finding, representing, and exploiting structure on the web. Okay, so the idea is that till now we looked at text documents and we looked at what kind of retrieval you can do on the text document. Using IR techniques, and then the fact that web pages are sort of like text documents, but they actually have a little more structure than that. Yes, and they use that structure. How did we use the structure of the web pages to improve retrieval? Yeah, even before that. Forget about the link analysis. Link analysis is one case in point, but we also use the structure of the pages to improve retrieval. Words in the title are given higher preference. Words in small font are given lower preference. That's structure. Okay. So, in fact, what we will see today and from now onwards is that clearly structure would improve querying. The question is, how do you represent structure? How can people easily write structured documents onto the web as against, let's say, text documents onto the web? Okay, if people can't be made to write text, structured documents, can you then take their text documents and extract structure out of it and then write it in a structured form? Okay, and so that's basically the first part, getting the structure, which is how do you allow people to provide structured documents? Okay, so there should be easy specification languages. This is where XML comes in. We'll talk about XML. And in fact, HTML is a subset of XML. It's a particular type of tags. So you already know HTML, which is basically a kind of an XML. So we'll look at more interesting properties of XML language, where you can define any random tags, and then essentially that provides, the structure to the document. Okay, so XML, interestingly, it would be more structured than text. It can be as much structured as you want it to be, depending on how much structure you want to put in. And then it's normally much less structured than databases. We will talk a little about databases today also because, if you talk about structure, if you talk about text, IR is where the normal retrieval mechanisms come from. To talk about structure, databases is where the normal querying mechanisms for structured data come from. So it's kind of useful to know databases, so I'll give a very quick 15-20 minute overview of the part of the databases that matter to all of us, so that if those of you who know, it'll just be a boring review. For those of you who don't know, it'll be a very fast overview of what you should have known. Okay, and then we will and then we'll talk about, XML, for example, as a way of providing, allowing people to write structured documents. Now, at a later point, we'll also see that if people cannot be forced to write XML documents, then if they have given documents, let's say they wrote it in Word, let's say, you can then realize that there's a section heading, which is in some bold letters, so you convert it into tag begin, tag end. So that's extracting structure. That's like a very primitive idea for extracting structure. So we'll in general, so if either structure is not explicitly specified, it's either because it's obfuscated. In fact, we talked about it in the beginning of the semester, and we'll talk about it again today, that sometimes, in fact, the data, the page that you're seeing is really produced by a database, which has structured records on this page. It just thought you understand English better, so it just munched all the structure and wrote a little text document for you. Okay, so it was obfuscating the structure, so you want to undo that obfuscation so that you'll get the structure back. Or even if it is a free text, you want to try and look for structure in it. Okay. These, the topics for this are wrapper generation and information extraction. So when we come there, you know, so this is the slide you have to keep coming back to for the rest of this semester in case you're lost as to why is this topic relevant. Okay, so if you ever start thinking about, when we talk about information extraction, this is where, this is the reason. Now, having found the structure, the question, of course, is how to use the structure. The next question is how to use the structure. Okay, you could use the structure just to improve retrieval. So that means get me the document written in XML which is most relevant to my query. Okay, this is what IR folks are most interested in. So one of the interesting things is because there is structure to the document, rather than just say get me a page which has the word Kambham Party in it, I could say get me a page which has the word Kambham Party in the field authors in it, or the word Kambham Party in the field references in it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So now if I want, for example, only papers written by Kambham Party, I can say get me the papers, get me the pages which have the word Kambham Party in the field author. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that will increase my relevance. Okay, so I get to say that and you get to get me better answers. Okay, so we will, from the IR point of view, it's all a question of what kind of additional keyword queries, you know, which structure can you specify and how can you answer them effectively. And a related issue is oftentimes that you may want to, you know, not only bring the page up, but there is a question of giving the snippet for the page. Okay, what's the best part of the page that satisfies this query? Those of you who went to Yi Chen's talk a couple of weeks back, she was basically talking about if you have a big XML file, which we'll see in a minute, can be seen as a big tree, then which subtree of this tree should I return to the user? Is the question. Okay, these are things that are essentially best understood as extensions of IR techniques. Okay, the other idea when you're talking about using structure, you can essentially start talking about providing database style query processing. Okay, the idea then would be that you would be able to combine a tuple from one table to a tuple from another table. You join them to answer queries, for example. Or you can aggregate tuples across tables to answer queries about the number of tuples with a certain property, the average of a certain value, and so on. Okay, these are queries that IR techniques don't have a clue of how to answer, because all they can do is give you pointers to the pages. Okay, this is really question answering. This normal IR queries basically say, if you ask a query, they say, go find it here. Go look for it here. Database style query processing, you ask a question, they give an answer. This is the answer. Okay, so you would be looking at how to use database style query processing techniques. First of all, you need to understand them, just as you needed to understand traditional IR techniques to talk about this extension. You also need to understand a little about traditional database query processing techniques. Okay, I more or less will assume that you know a lot of it, but at least I'll remind you the pieces that I want you to refresh your mind about. Okay. And then, so then the question would be how to combine, use that, you know. So for example, many of you would probably remember, many of you probably know that the relational databases, the query language for relational databases is SQL, okay? So if you view XML, for example, from a database point of view, the question would be what would be an SQL-like query language for XML documents? And it turns out there's now a standard called XQuery, which is the XML-like query document. Okay? And similarly, if you view XML as just a structured text, then you would be asking what is the extension of normal keyword queries that can somehow exploit structure too. And that's what IR guys will do. Now, XQuery actually is supposedly designed to aim to make both IR folks and database folks happy, but it's really more database dominated. We'll see that later. Okay. But really the idea here is you're answering queries rather than making pointers to places where the queries may have answers. Okay? And then the other thing, as you go from this here, which is just go there, you might find the answer you're looking for. To here is your answer as far as these pages are concerned. I might also actually basically do knowledge-based inference. Okay, so the idea is I might be able to say not just joins, I might actually be able to do logical reasoning over the knowledge that I have to answer queries. Okay, that would be semantic web ideas. I won't go too much into it now. When we get there, you'll get a better feel for it. Okay, for example, if you, for example, asked for are there any mammals, I mean, how many mammals are listed in the pages that you have, right? Then now you may know in the background that elephants are mammals, and you know, humans are mammals, and so on and so forth. Using this, you will count all the humans listed, all the elephants listed, and then give the number of mammals listed. Okay, now how would I know that the document has elephant? I'll assume that there is a tag saying elephant begin, elephant end. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if I just asked, you know, here I could have asked how many elephants are there in your database. Here I could say how many mammals are there in your database. Okay, where now I'm using the background knowledge to, interpret the query in a logical sense. Okay, so that's sort of semantic web, sort of an idea. We will come to that too. Okay, now, so these are like the two important things, getting structure and using structure. One complication on the web is that there are multiple sources, there are multiple pages. Okay, one of the most interesting things is the moment you start having structure, different people might give different, you know, structures for similar pages. Okay, so for example, I have, since we are into elephants right now, here is a page one which says elephant begin, and then Fido, and you know, bunch of information about it, and you know, elephant end. Okay, that's one page. Another page is sort of Latinesque, and it says pachyderm begin. That, by the way, I think is a name for elephant too. And then pachyderm end. And then says Lucy, and more information about Lucy. Right? Now, the question is, how do I realize that the elephant here is the same as pachyderm here? Okay, or more interestingly, in fact, even crazier things can happen. I can have one source which gives each employee and their salary in a company C1. Another source which gives the total number of employees in that company and the average salary per employee in that company. Now, you want to write a query which basically says for both these companies, total number of employees and the total amount spent on salaries. To be able to answer that, you need to realize how the averages and the salaries are connected. Do you understand what I'm saying? So until now, in fact, even if you have thought about databases, which we will refresh your mind in a minute, you have thought about schemas for databases. Okay, the schema is supposed to tell you things like there is an elephant table which has a bunch of columns telling you properties of the elephants. Okay, but if somebody else writes an elephant table, they may have different set of columns with differing names. And how do you figure out that the column here is the same as the column here? The moment you have structure, you need to talk about aligning structure. If you don't have structure, you don't have nothing to align, because you have a bunch of text here, you have a bunch of text here, it's a bag of words, put together two bags of words, you've got a bigger bag of words. You understand what I'm saying? But the moment you start saying I have structure, then you need to talk about aligning it. Okay, here is somebody with some structure, here is somebody with some structure, are they talking about the same structure? And that's a hard question. Okay, if somehow you can put all the data of the web into one single database which has a schema that you design, then this goes away. But to actually put all the database data of the web into a single database with a schema you designed, you solved it yourself. You are essentially inputting the world's data into your database. You are aligning, you know, random bits of data into the schema that you have. You understand what I'm saying? And this could be quite non-trivial unless your database schema essentially says text. That's it. Okay, and then you basically put everything as a text in the text column, which is more or less what we did for the text documents in IaaS. Okay, so how to align the structure is a very big deal. Okay, we'll talk about that a lot of times towards the end. And then the other related issue is having, you know, for example, if I have a source which has whole bunch of information about elephants, another source a whole bunch of information about pachyderms, right? And I have a query, can I easily run the query on both, integrate the answers and give me the single answer, rather than me going and asking a query here and asking a query here? That is essentially how to support integrated querying on the structured pages. Okay, so that's where we'll talk about data integration, information integration. Okay, so this is my attempt at trying to put some structure on the rest of the semester. Okay, so anytime you're worried as to what are we doing, you can come back here and see why we are doing the various parts. It's all about structure, but you know, given the structure, you need to talk about how to represent it, how to use it, and how to, and then what are the extra challenges in terms of the fact that there are multiple sources with structure. Okay, so this is basically about the rest of the semester. Question? Yes, sir.
Won't you apply structure and kind of act more like a relational database?
That's one of the things that we will look at.
So you still have the concepts of precision and recall? And
yes. Relevance. Keep that in back of your mind. So for example, in fact, the very next thing we'll be talking about is, since the last thing that we have ever read about, which cared about structure in the data, is databases, we may as well get to the same page and at least remember what databases were doing. It may be that they're doing exactly what we need. It may be that they're doing any part of what we need. But, you know, there's no badges given for reinventing the wheel, right? So we should at least know what databases are doing. And those are very good questions. So, for example, in databases, we never talked about precision and recall, right? In normal databases, that if you took in 412, there is no precision and recall. Why? Because precision is supposed to be one and recall is supposed to be one. And so the only way two database managers are different is one of them answers the query faster than the other one. Okay, now that is because databases is an abstraction of the real world. It turns out that, you know, there are, in fact, there are no users out there who really want all answers necessarily. Okay, and so they may not necessarily demand 1.0 recall. And if, in fact, 1.0 recall will require 10 days of processing, they definitely don't want it. Okay? And sometimes, if the underlying database is a probabilistic database, in the sense you're not quite sure whether this tuple actually exists or not, then precision can't be one. Okay? So one of the interesting things is, in trying to help web, IR got changed. Right? IR was one of the three things that, if you look at the next one, okay, by the way, we'll come back to this in a minute, but if you look at this, information retrieval, machine learning, and, you know, databases are like three existing things that we wind up reusing and extending in the context of web, right? IR got changed because it got used in the context of web. There are certain things that they never thought of doing that they learned more, okay? And similarly, databases help us, and also we help databases, in fact, to actually remain useful in this day and age. Databases have to not say, we'll only do precision one, recall one kind of query processing. That would only be relevant in small number of scenarios, the ones that you looked at in the fourth fall. Okay, and one other thing, interestingly, that we'll look at is databases, for example, have this querying language called structured querying language, SQL. Those of you who know SQL queries, they can be one page long. You can really specify a very involved question on the database, and that could be answered. have you seen a bozo who actually uses a web and can write one page long query, whether it's in SQL or not? Right? We have bozos who use 2.1 words long queries. Okay? So they're not going to suddenly become more sophisticated because there are databases on the other side. Okay? So in fact, one of the interesting questions would be, what should databases do if they get keyword queries? This is something that databases have to worry about. Again, you know, I brought this up. We're going to bring this up again towards in the middle of today's class, but I brought this up because you were interested in that question. And it's like, these are the kinds of things we have to wonder. You know, I mean, it's like a mutual influence. Databases help web, web help databases. Okay? Now, the two sites that I skipped over, essentially I'm just reminding you that the fact that structure is a big deal is something that I mentioned in the very first class. This is a slide from the very first class where I said, you know, what kind of queries you can answer depends on what kind of data you have, okay? If you have just a bunch of English text, you have an employee record or a movie review. The difference between an employee record could be very structured. It says, you know, here is the name of the employee, here is the social security number, here is the salary, et cetera, et cetera. And a movie review, on the other hand, there are some structured columns, like the person who wrote the review, the name of the movie, et cetera. And then some very unstructured columns, which is the review, which is a paragraph of English. Right? And so that would be sort of in between, and this would be like a semi-structured data. And when we were talking about, you know, supporting structure, we never said we should go from no structure to full structure. First of all, there is no such thing as full structure. You can give more and more structure to a data. You know, so from the database point of view, we are actually coming down in structure and supporting querying on little less structured data than what we are used to. From the IR point of view, we are increasing the structure. You know, we are supporting querying on, you know, data that has more structure than we are used to. Okay? Yes, sir.
How do you verify structure? I mean,
how do you verify a document on the web? Yeah. Again, these are, in fact, these are questions you should ask yourself and, you know, make sure that you get over it, because, you know, there is no way of quote-unquote verifying structure, okay? One of the interesting things is, unless there are standard semantics for these tags, okay? And one big thing we will notice, and, you know, how many of you think that XML tags have meaning? Do you know what XML is? Well, first of all, those of you who don't know, don't care. But XML tags have no meaning, and we'll talk about it today. HTML tags have meaning. Okay? That's because all of us decided that HTML pages will only be rendered by a very specific rendering engine, and so it provides the procedural meaning for HTML tags. No, but that still doesn't mean anything. We'll keep that in mind. I have a bunch of slides that will explain this point multiple times, you know, and in fact, last few times I've been yelled at for pushing this point too much. But, you know, if I don't get to do enough of it, but I'll get two of you into my room and say it for an hour or so until you agree with me. But anyway, you know, it's a very interesting point that, you know, XML is a syntactic standard. It's not a semantic standard. Okay, we will look at that. Okay. So the reason structure is useful is because, again, another slide we showed in the very beginning of the course, and this is all going to come and haunt you now, is that you could ask this query, if, you know, give me all the pages that have keyword get rich quick. That's a simple kind of a query that IR can do. Okay? You could ask this query, give me the social security numbers of all the employees who have stayed with the company for more than 5 years and whose yearly salaries are 3 standard deviations away from the average salary. So these are the fat cats. So we would want to, you know, cut down their salaries, you know, and, you know, improve the recession or something. And, you know, you can answer this if you have databases. Now, you may ask, who are the people who have this kind of queries? There are people. No, it's like, it's not that there are, you know, 98% of the people who are on the web apparently only check for flu, as you found out yesterday, right? But the rest of us, there may be a few people who might be asking much more sophisticated long queries. And if you want to support that, you need the structure. And here is a query, Give me all the mails from people from ASU written this year which are relevant to get rich quick. That's a classic case of a query which requires essentially structure for answering the first part and keywords for answering the second part. And we talked about in the very beginning of the semester, now it's all going to basically, we are trying to talk about what standards do we use to, you know, support the structure writing, etc. Okay. So we'll look at databases. So having said the structure is important, I'm going to talk a little about databases because databases look at fully structured data, which is like the other end from the IR. Okay. So it's worth understanding how that end works so that we can talk about the middle. Okay. So now, why do we care about databases? You know, at least here are some motivations, apart from the motivation I already gave you, which is that, you know, it's a traditional discipline that looks at fully structured data. Deep web actually is all databases. In fact, one of the big issues is that it's not just pages that exist on the web. There are many, many databases that lurk behind the web. And when you send a query, they then intercept the query, run it on the underlying database, generate pages, and then show it to you. Okay, and the reason why are these people doing this? Because they wanted more customers. Previously, only the bozos who knew SQL were having access to these databases. Now they want more people. So Amazon has a database of all the books itself. There are Amazon engineers who write SQL queries on that database to answer questions such as, are there books that have been hanging about for more than 6 months with sales less than 754,000th rank? If so, we don't want to keep those books anymore. They will ask that question. Okay, for that they'll support SQL. But for you, they support basically, you know, you enter a bunch of keywords and they're looking for, you know, records of books and show it to you in some sort of an English fashion. Okay, so that's Amazon is a classic case of a deep web database. And notice that if you write a query to Google, for example, or any of the search engines, they will give you answers from Amazon too. How did they do it? In fact, that's one of the questions we want to understand. How did they do it? Did they take your query, give it to Amazon, get the answers and put them on the top? Or, you know, how did they wind up indexing those pages that Amazon, that exists in the Amazon database? Okay, but either way, there are databases in the behind the web, and you want to be able to exploit them. Okay, and we can do better with structured data. That's the whole argument that I've been doing for the past several minutes. And then the third point, which I also made somewhat in answer to you, is, you know, exposing databases to the web changes their clientele. It's no longer people who know how to write one-page SQL queries. You have people who don't quite know what they're looking for and think that a couple of keywords will be more than enough for people to divine what's in their mind, which is exactly the same IR clientele. They're not changing just because you have a database now. So what does it mean for a database to live with these kinds of clients? Now you could say, I don't want these kind of clients, then you will continue to have, you know, 1800 SQL savvy people. Or you can say, I'll open up and, you know, you'll have, you know, billions of people accessing you. Or in essence, what you have right now is a combined thing where, you know, like Amazon will support SQL queries from their engineers and support keyword queries from everybody. Okay? So this, you can go back and look at it. You know, there are lots and lots of databases on the web, and then there's different people come up with different numbers as to how much of the data on the web is really deep web rather than the crawlable web, which is normal pages. Okay, and then we also look at, so one of the interesting things is that when you have databases on the deep web, you know, the issues of, for example, multiple databases with different structures, and they need to be combined together. So for example, Amazon and Barnes & Noble both have books. They don't necessarily have to agree on the columns that they use to describe their books. If you want to provide comparison shopping, if you want to provide aggregation, How do you do that? That's the question that we were talking about earlier. How do you align structures? Okay? And this comes because essentially you have more than one database. Most people just have one database. I mean, the whole database technology is for a single database normally. Okay? So you have multiple databases written with different schemas, and how do you combine them and answer queries together? Okay? And then, you know, how to even pick databases. Just as you can talk about how to pick relevant pages, if they had too many databases, you first have to pick the databases that are going to be relevant to the query. And then align them. And then integrate. That means answer queries over them. All these issues that we have to deal with, you know, once we realize that, in fact, there are databases on the web. Okay. And then this we already talked about in terms of structure. The fact that databases have structure and that they are like the ones that provide us lessons as to what you can do, what sort of technology has developed in, you know, handling structure in databases. Okay, so let's quickly review some stuff about databases. Okay, so you have used, yes, sir. Is it or is it not? That's a very good question, by the way.
Otherwise, how are you going to use that query on your structured data?
I don't know. I mean, all I can say is you have to think about this. So if I have structured data, first of all, you have to realize that because I have structured data, I won't be any worse than somebody who has unstructured data in supporting keyword query. But furthermore, in fact, we will see that you can provide better. You know, for example, think about the following keyword query. Model accord. That's a keyword query. There are two keywords, model, accord. Okay, if it's a bunch of text, they're just looking for model and accord in somewhere in that page. If I have structured data, I can say, well, one reasonable thing to do is if there is a tuple whose model happens to be accord. It's not enough that they're in the same page. Do you understand what I'm saying? Again, the assumption is the guy who basically was looking for structured data but gave the query in a keyword form, where the keywords, some of them are attributes, some of them are values. Well, you can, if you actually have structured data, right, you could, for example, realize that model appears more often as a column name in the data that you have, and accord appears more often as a value name. Okay, again, I cannot answer all your queries in today's class, but these are all very relevant queries, and, you know, I hope that you will know how to answer these by the end of this third topic. Okay, and it is indeed a very reasonable question to ask yourself, why should I have structured data if the queries are unstructured? Okay, and here is an example that, in fact, you know, structured data does help, even if the queries are unstructured. Because remember that IR never really said that a page is an answer to the query only if certain syntactic restrictions are satisfied. IR said a page is an answer to a query if the user who gave the query likes it. That's the way we went with it. So a page which does not have these words at all may still be relevant. That's the way IR defines precision and recall. So you can very well improve precision and recall under these assumptions that people actually have, you know, default schemas for the data they're looking for. Yes. I mean, again, with every opportunity comes, you know, ways of either not using it or actually misusing it. Okay. But all I wanted to answer in his case is it's not at all the case that you must have SQL queries to be able to satisfy databases. In fact, there is a whole amount of research that's being done in completely structured databases. No, you can, if you bring structure to the query, you can exploit the structured data even more. But that's different. One thing you learn as a business person is you don't tell customers how to behave. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can clean up your shop. You can put neon lights. You can't say all the customers who come should have neon lights on their head. If you do, then I can do better service, but they won't come. You're right that if they gave you structured queries. No, but it's also right that if all the people of the world essentially are much better, much more literate and know approximately what the symptoms of the flu are, et cetera, you know, most of the search engines may not even be needed. Okay, but the point is, even if they don't know how to write a structured query, you can still answer their queries better because you have access to structure.
Okay, but then don't you think it becomes a question of natural language processing?
Everything is supposed to be natural language processing. The question is, how far can we get without doing full natural language processing? Okay, IR is supposed to be natural language processing, but without doing it. Okay, databases is natural language processing without doing it, but because you actually give the columns. We assume that everybody knows the same thing about the columns. Again, these are important questions. I don't mean to rush you into an answer, but I can't answer it completely today. You know, part of the next several lectures have to give you the feel for it. So, a database system is an integrated collection of data. It has essentially, you know, how many of you have taken a database course, have heard of databases? Okay, the rest of you, there are, you know, refresher links, just at least read them. I know as to which parts of the refresher you need, you know, I'm telling you today. Okay, so you think of the world as made up of entities and relationships between them, and then you essentially start writing these entity relationships in some sort of a structured format. Okay, the most obvious form, there have been lots and lots of models for databases, object-oriented ones and so on, but the one that has sort of become the default standard in databases is relational databases, where, you know, ultimately everything is, you know, written as a bunch of relations, and each relation is best thought of as a table with columns. A relation, the table's name is the relation name, and the columns are the names of the different attributes of the relation. So, for example, the relation, so for example, I can have, you want to define a student in terms of the social security number, the name, the age, GPA, etc., right? Then you have a table for the student, and the columns of this table are essentially, here is SID, here is name, here is age, here is GPA, and so on. And each row corresponds to a student. That's the basic idea, okay? And having written this, now if I am, so if I have this, you can, you know, you have multiple relations. You have a student name, and then there may also be a course relation. And the course relation basically contains name of the course ID, and the teacher, for example, okay? And then course student could have the information about the students enrolled in the course, okay? And you can answer queries by taking these tables and joining them, which is what I'm going to just describe quickly. So a database management system is something that's designed to store, manage, and facilitate access to databases. You know, if you are in doubt, think of them as big tables that are efficiently manipulated. Now, what are the things that you want from a traditional database? You want a storage database. They provide storage management. They provide high-level query manipulation languages, where the query only says what the answer should satisfy, and how to run the query is decided by the database manager. That's the basic logical querying, you know, declarative query, and you don't tell them how to answer the query, you tell them what the query is, okay? And then efficient query processing involves taking any arbitrary query, looking at your database, and deciding what's the best way to answer that query, okay? And then there are a bunch of things that we don't care about in this class, but you know, we would care eventually if we continue thinking of web-bound databases. One of which is transaction processing. You know, those of you who saw Communications of ACM this month, there's a picture of guy Jim Meyer on top of it. And he was one of the guys who started talking about transaction processing. And the interesting thing is when you have online databases that are being modified by people, okay, a classic case is a bank has a database of all the accounts, right? And then when you go to an ATM and you put in your card and then you type in your PIN and you say, I want $200, and then the transaction started, then the power fails so that you don't get any money. You would be a really unhappy guy if the 200 has been subtracted from the database. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's transaction processing. How do you make sure that irrespective of what bad things happen, either a transaction completes fully or that database is rolled back to what the database was before the transaction was initiated? It's a very important thing in ATMs, right? And it's important also in the credit card, online credit card transaction. This is why they say after you give the credit card information, they say, don't bother us until we come back with a confirmation saying we are done. But really, transaction processing is important in that sort of scenario where you're changing the database itself. Much of what we'll be doing in today's in this course is we are only the readers of a database. Transactions become important if we are not only readers but also writers of a database. ATM requires transactions because bank wrote into your account saying you have $500. And you, by withdrawing money, you are writing into the database saying I have now $200 left. And when you have this kind of transactions going on, when you can write into the database, then you need to think about transaction processing. On the web, the classic case would be credit card transactions, for example. We won't talk too much about that. And as I said, resiliency, recovery from crashes, if something goes wrong with the database, it should go back to a stable state. Okay? And then one thing that we do care about is that just because you have a database, not everybody gets to see the entire database. As I said, Amazon has a database. And in fact, I gave you an example of a query that Amazon engineers can answer that you can't get an answer for. What was it? Give me an example of a query that Amazon engineers can answer. But you have access to Amazon database, but you can't answer. That's one thing, yes. For example, tell me all the books that you have been unable to sell. They won't tell you for secret reasons. But there are other things that you would think is like directly available, because in fact, that the point about that is even when they show you the book, you still don't know how long the book has been in their catalog. But think of a query, give me all the books which have more than 750 pages and less than 775 pages. Every book that is returned has the information as to how many pages are there in the book. But you still can't ask them that question. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can answer that question though in an indirect way, which is, give up your job, keep asking Amazon for book after book after book after book, check whether they have more than 775 and less than, more than 750 and less than 775, and filter them out. But they don't directly answer themselves. Okay, so what is happening in those kinds of scenarios is everybody has a view of the database, which is just a subset of the queries that you are allowed to run on the database. Okay, and that happens, for example, ASU maintains a database, right? But for example, you have an access to that, but you don't get to ask all random queries such as, what's the average, GPA of my competitors? You don't get to ask that. ASU knows, but they won't give it to you. Okay, so you are given a view, and I'm given a view into the ASU database. And the advising people are given a different view into the ASU database. And they have different write and read privileges. Okay, so that's the other interesting thing about databases. You give a query in some structured language. If it's a relational database, you give a query in SQL. And database manager sits between the query and the database. And if it's relational, then think of them as tables. And database manager provides storage management, query processing, and view management. And if you're also writing, transaction management. okay? And then you get an answer back. In SQL, I mean, sorry, in relational databases, an answer is always a table. An answer is always a table. Okay? The query is not a table though. Query is in SQL. But answer is a table. Okay? And it's a particular relation that just satisfies that query and nothing else. Okay? I'll skip over this. So the one thing is, you know, how to design a database schema. So if you have a particular application in mind, you need to think about what are all the things that you want to write about, what are their properties. So you first sit down and let's say I ask you, write a student, a database for keeping the student data. Then you would have to say, well, yeah, such a thing will contain information about students, courses, professors, and they have relations. Students take courses, professors teach courses, professors also advise students. Students may have the following properties, social security number, name, category. Professors have the following properties. Courses have the following properties. This is what I've decided. Now, here's my question. If I wrote this, so if I asked you to come up with a student database, what is the a schema for a student database? Once I come up with this, then I can make it into a schema reasonably well. What is the chance that you would have come up with these exact names for professor, course, student, and the exact properties next to null? As long as I'm the only guy who makes the database and everybody else gets to use it, it's okay. If there are multiple people making databases and somebody is trying to use multiple databases together, the fact that somebody calls this guy professor and somebody calls this guy teacher, and somebody calls this guy student, somebody calls this guy course taker, changes everything, at least syntactically. Okay? The part that we take for granted, saying, yeah, you have to write a schema, you know, it's a big deal because different people are likely to write different schemas. This is exactly the point of structure alignment problem. Okay? So data model, schema, and then a relational model of a data is basically a bunch of tables. Let's see, do we care about these? And then, you know, one of the big things that people in databases talk about and care about is the independence between levels of the database. So for example, there is the data itself which is stored in some indexes and with some indexes and, you know, the efficient way of storing them using B-trees and so on. The physical schema tells you how the data is actually laid out on the disk. The conceptual schema basically tells you the entities and relations. What are the relation names and what are the attributes? And then the views tell you the schemas for different kinds of users. This is the professor schema, this is the student schema, this is the administrator schema. All of which are really subset of the total schema. Okay? So here in the case of student thing, conceptual schema might have students relation and courses relation. Whenever somebody says, give me the schema of the database, they're asking about information like this. All relational databases are flat. It's a bunch of relation names with their attributes. That's it. Okay, so as long as you give you the relation names and all the attributes for each of those relations, then you're given the schema. Okay, you might also, for each of the attributes, provide the data type that is going to be represented there. Is it a string? Is it an integer or something? Okay, so you have students and courses. An external schema would be something that you could have made, for example, say course information, which only gives you the course ID and the number of enrollment, number of people currently in it, without telling you the names of the people who are there, which is more or less what you get to see when you try to register for Spring 2009 courses. You shouldn't be allowed to see who is in the course, for example. So that's what your view is, okay? And the physical schema, of course, tells you exactly how the tuples are actually organized on the disk. We would not even care about it now. Now, this was the point I was making. If five people are asked to come up with a schema for the data, what's the chance that they'll all come up with the same schema? Next to zero, right? And then, so there are all these, because you separate physical schema from conceptual schema and conceptual schema from a view schema, you can change one of these without changing the other. So like if I change physical schema, all I need to do is map these two. And people using conceptual schema don't need to know that anything changed. it's like a big deal from a database point of view. It's not as big a deal from far from our point of view right now. Okay. And you know, you can think about why are these kinds of independence particularly useful to databases. I'll let you think about it, and you probably know the answers too. And as I said, all the relations would be represented as tables. You know, here is a student table, you know, student name, the course number, and the quarter, for example, in which that course is being offered. The names of the columns are called attributes. The name of the entire table is the relation name. The each row corresponds to a tuple, which is basically a database record. Okay. If you don't know the value of a particular column, then you say that's a null value. I don't know. Traditional databases assume there are no null values. Everything, you know, every tuple has every value filled in. Okay. And also, for example, you would in a traditional database, a table by definition has fixed width, because a table has certain number of columns. Suppose I have a book. I want to write a table for the book. I need, for example, a field for the author. How many fields am I supposed to have for the author for a book? One. Yes, every book at least has one author. But there are books with two authors. There are books with three authors. There are books with many, many authors. So how many exact number of columns are you going to have, title, author one, author two, etc., author n? So one arbitrary thing to do is saying, oh, no book has more than 10 authors. So I'll say every table has author 1 up to author 10. Okay, and if this is a book with one author, then author 1's name is there. All the other authors you put, you know, essentially no or something. Okay, but here is a situation where you realize that if just because you have tables, the world doesn't come with fixed width relations. Okay, and we'll see, for example, when we look at XML, that this becomes a non-issue. You can have any number of writer tags in a particular book record. Okay, but what that means, of course, is that there is no fixed width table representation of an XML file. Okay. Now, querying databases made up of basically these kinds of tables, essentially you use SQL language. And so it's like select something from some number of named tables where certain conditions are satisfied. That's what the query is. Okay. So now query processor figures out how to answer the query, which tables to access, what is the order to access them, and you know how to get the answer. That's what that you leave it to the query processor. But given this query, you can tell whether a tuple is an answer or not. You know, all query processor does is generating the answers fast. Okay. Now, defining a view can just be thought of as the queries that you're allowed to ask. Do you understand what I'm saying? A view really is a query. So if I want to restrict your ability to look into the database, I will restrict your queries into the database. And I say, these are the only queries you get to ask. And answers to this query are available to you. And once you can ask this query, then you can, of course, see just, you know, if that basically that query defines a table now. And you can always, if I have a table with 100 columns, I can also look at just the first two columns because I got the 100 columns in front of me. So the scope of a view really is best thought of as a query. Okay, a view is a query. That's the way to think about it. And in fact, think of views as macros. Those of you who know C language or something, a view is a macro over the relation. It's a macro relation. It's defined in terms of the underlying schema relation. So wherever the view comes, you could have put, you know, this macro definition. Now there are, and you can see why the views are important. As I said, this reduces the, so all that you can do, suppose I have a view for purchases of telephony product. So this is a view, it's a macro, telephony purchases. And that's a table that is available. Now you can use this table and write other SQL queries on this table, saying select only ones which have my name in it. I select only the rows of these which have less than $400. But the point is you cannot go beyond these two other parts of the database. That's what is being restricted when you give a view. Okay? A view is an important point for our interest because in particular if there are multiple sources on the web, Think of a situation where there are multiple databases, all of which say we have movie information. We'll tell you all about the movies that have been made. Movies are reasonably structured. They have directors, they have actors, they have the year of make and all that stuff. If there's one single database, then it's fine. But unfortunately, there are multiple databases. The question then is, how do they connect to the real movie database that God has made? Okay? And the easiest way to think about it is that every one of these guys went to the big database of movies, selected some part of it, and said, that's our movie database. So these are views into the full database of movies that you don't have access to. In normal databases, you have the database as well as the macro views. Okay? What if, in fact, I basically, in the scenario that I gave you, I have a big database, a big table of movies, and IMDb goes and says, oh, these are all the pieces that we'll keep. That's IMDb. So they use some columns and also reduce some rows. Okay? And then here is some other database which basically says we'll take this. Okay? And here is another database which makes up movies. Right? I mean, on the web I can make up stuff. Right? So this guy essentially took more than the number of movies that were really made in the entire world. Okay? And this could have happened in IMDb because IMDb is more complete for Hollywood movies and they are nowhere near as complete for Telugu movies. So they didn't take, you know, they were racist. They did not take Telugu movies. Okay? And these guys, on the other hand, made up movies. So they have a soundness problem. Okay? Now the question is, what happens in this case is these are all views into the original schema. Forget about this guy. This guy is hopeless. There are views in the schema. Except IMDb is not saying I only will basically, a normal view, in a C macro is just defined virtually. And at the runtime, it's expanded inline. Similarly, a virtual view is defined by the query. And if you use a query which uses the view name as a relation, then at the runtime, basically, that view is expanded to that query. Do you understand what I'm saying? So here is a, we defined telephony purchases. Here we defined Seattle view as two views. And then I made a new query which uses Seattle view, which is a view. Okay? And all that happens during the actual query processing is that this is expanded into this and then it's run on the central database. That's more or less what happens when you look into the courses databases of ASU. ASU only has one single course database. But you only allowed to ask certain queries on it as limited by a particular view. That's the student course information view. And you ask queries on that view, then they expand it into the normal schema, answer it on the big database. Those are called virtual views. The view doesn't actually exist, it's just a macro. Here, these are also views, but these views are different. IMDb is the only thing I have access to, you know, and similarly, some other database is the only thing I have access to. I don't actually know what is the full list of all the movies that have been made in the world. Just a second. Okay? Right? So, in these cases, what happens is IMDb is a materialized view. It's a materialized view. So they looked into the, if you want to conceptualize what IMDb is doing, at the beginning of the creation, they went and took a bunch of movies from the real movie database and they stored it in their hard disk. You could do it too. Right? For example, today you go find out how many seats are left in each of the courses and store it in your homepage. And your friends then don't have to go to the ASU homepage. Even if it ducks down, you are there. The problem, of course, is this is sort of reminds me of Fahrenheit 411. Why does that remind me of Fahrenheit 411? Fahrenheit 411, does anybody know what it is? You know Fahrenheit 911, because you're young enough. But the reason it's called Fahrenheit 9/11 is Fahrenheit 4/11, I believe, is the original Ray Bradbury book, where there's a huge censorship. The books are being destroyed. So everybody becomes a book. So they read up the book, and their whole life is to be that book. That's how they keep the knowledge of the world. The world that was, which is this green table, is gone. All I have is these guys who act as the books. Fahrenheit 4/11 is fine because the books don't change anymore. So your copy of the book is really the only reality that is there. If you do it on the ASU database, you are going to be out of whack with the original database, because 2 days later you will be still thinking that, you know, there are 7 seats in this course. It may have more or less than 7 seats, actually. Okay? The whole reason for this that I brought up is, if you think of database sources on the web, they are really materialized views on some big database that existed. And that thinking of it that way conceptually helps in actually writing query processing algorithms for this. You had a question. You can, but that will still give you only a part of it. In fact, that's part of the things that we'll wind up doing in data aggregation, you know, approaches. One of the things, for example, is consider something as simple as a CS paper bibliography database. There is DBLP, which provides CS papers. They say they provide all CS papers. I write a paper in a fourth-rate database conference. Before I send the paper out, DBLP has a listing on that. I write a paper on an AI conference, that guy doesn't care about AI, so he doesn't wake up and write the link into it. So what is DBLP? It's more complete for database and logic programming. That's why it's called DBLP, okay? Databases and logic programming, okay? You probably didn't think about it. And less complete for AI and pattern recognition and machine learning, all that nonsense. Right? And then so I can make one thing called machine learning database. And that will have machine learning pages. And I can have Google Scholar, which has its own listings. Now the problem, of course, is if I want all the papers that are ever written by me, which is the only important query I have, right? So I need to essentially combine all these guys. And furthermore, if I ever need a BibTeX entry for a paper ready-made, I go to DBLP, because those guys actually type down their BibTeX entry, okay? Whereas Google Scholar doesn't. So what that essentially means is DBLP is like this, I'm sorry, let's say it's like this, it's complete for databases, not complete for the rest of the guys, but it has more information, more columns. Somebody else might have less columns and slightly more complete. It's exactly the points we'll think about when we talk about combining multiple data sources to answer aggregation queries. Okay? So to some extent, that question sort of vindicates my point that we are looking at databases not just as 412 review, but in terms of 412 in the context of web. Because you won't ask this question in 412. Because there's only one single database. What do you mean multiple book databases? Right? Okay. Now, we would not talk about updates at all, so, you know, since we don't talk about updating databases, we don't talk about updating views. But there are very interesting issues of updating views. Even if you have write privileges, what does it mean to update a view? It becomes a very interesting question, but we won't talk about it. Okay. And this is materialized views, as I pointed out, is the best way to think of data sources on the web. And then there is a whole entire area of query optimization, which basically takes SQL queries written with views and so on, and then tries to answer them fast on the underlying database. And this is a beautiful theory. We won't talk about it either, okay? Because, you know, not necessary for the kinds of things I want to talk about here. Okay. Now, the last point I want to make with respect to databases is repeat what I mentioned earlier, which is that it's not just databases helping web, it's web helping databases too. Web brings unvast masses, unreliable medium, as well as dirty data to the databases. You could say, I don't want it, and then you'll be a boring community. okay, because all the action is somewhere there, and you close your door and sit in this room where it is nice and clean. Okay, but if you want to go out into the real world, you need to worry about how to support, you know, users who don't quite know what they're asking for, but still want correct answers. How to support query processing when the source statistics are not available, like selectivity statistics, etc., which are important to do query processing, are not available because data sources don't give it to you. You have to learn them. Okay? How to support query processing when not all rows are complete. There may be multiple missing values. And here is a really shiny new car, and this user is looking for Honda Accords. And there is a tuple, you know, in the used car database, which says Accord for $200, extremely good condition. If you're a database, you'll say, I know it's not a Honda Accord, and you get out of that. Okay? The user who entered that data might have thought that there is no bozo in the world who doesn't realize that Accords are made by Honda. Okay? But the database fails to bring that out because there's a null value in the make. How can you realize that the missing value is actually Honda without being told, you the database manager? That's something that we want to do. You know, in fact, for example, you can realize that every other Accord is being made by Honda in the database. So it's very likely that this too is made by Honda. You're going to classify, you're going to predict the missing value. Okay? So that's something that you can do for databases. Okay? So how does one support keyword queries in the databases? How does one support imprecise queries in the databases where the user asks for Accords, but they wouldn't mind getting Toyotas, Camrys. But they may not like getting Yugos. How do you realize that? And they may not also like getting onions. How do you realize that? Okay, they ask for something, you're giving more than what they're asked for, and they're happy, which is basically what information retrieval does. And it's something databases never do. But they have to do that because their client is the same clientele now. Okay? How do we handle incompleteness and inconsistency in the databases? As I said, there are missing rows, there are missing columns. Okay, how do you make up for that? And does it make sense to focus on the total response time of a database in answering the query at all? For example, if I say, you know, give me some of the best movies in the world, and all I have is a bunch of sources, one of these sources is very slow. It's in Swaziland somewhere, okay, and it's only switched on every 3 days, okay? In theory, if you want to get all the answers, you have to wait for that also to come up. And you don't want to give any answers that might be less than 1.0 recap. So you won't get any users asking you anymore. Okay, so how do you answer queries when, in fact, the holy grail is to get precision 1.0 and recall 1.0, but you need to get there slowly. And, you know, something like the cars, I mean, something like the, you know, the movies is easy. Think of a query which says, what is the average price of Accords made in 2000 in your database? And there are a bunch of used car databases. Now the average changes based on every extra tuple. What do you do then? Here is an idea, show a running average. And they're just in front of you keep changing. Sort of like a stock market right now, right? And you can basically get an idea, which is better than saying, from now until day after tomorrow, the screen will be blank, and day after tomorrow, I'll give you the correct answer. But there would be nobody to see it, okay? So again, these are issues that become very important in databases because they are available on the web, and the same users who are doing keyword querying are also doing database queries. Okay, so if you go to SIGMOD right now, or the VLDB, or ICDE, which are, you know, the three big conferences in databases, very few people do what's the traditional database work. There's a lot of work which goes on those questions. Okay, so that's where all the action is right now. Okay? That's the end of the databases. What I want to do, since I still have 3 minutes, is to explain to you what we are going to do next class, which is basically XML. So we did the databases as a way of using full structure, but by this page we realized that really databases also don't have full structure. They may have missing values, they may have missing tuples and so on. But at least the technology was developed for fully structured data. And then you also knew how to do fully unstructured data, which is IR. The question is, how do you specify structure when the structure is partial? Okay, it could be partial in multiple ways. One is that all I can say is this part is just text. And sometimes I can also say that there are some number of authors to this book, clean star operator, you know, clean plus operator. There is one or more authors to each book. That basically doesn't tell you exactly how many authors are there for each book. But that's the only thing you know about the word. Okay? So you can think of XML standard as something that you can come to from IR because you want to allow more structure, or from databases because you want to allow less structure. And if you are not surprised by this picture, then you have understood what we've been trying to do today's class. Okay, database people go out to the full structure side. There is not enough fully structured data. IR folks concentrate on fully unstructured data. And if people want to give you structure, not being able to allow them a way of specifying that and exploiting that structure is a losing proposition. Okay, so what we really want to do is to think of something which will allow us to talk about, structure, that what structure you know, you explain, you write it. What you don't have to write. Okay, and a simple XML is such a standard, and it looks like this. And most of you probably know it looks like an HTML page, except where you'd have had HTML tags, I just made up any tag I felt like. That's what an XML page is. XML page is a bunch of tags, on the tag ends. Okay, and each tag can have attributes too. For example, show is a tag, and show has to end somewhere here. It ended here. And show also has an attribute, which is an extra property. And then this tag has sub-tags, title, review, etc. So one way of looking at it is it almost looks like it's a show table with columns being defined. But it's a little more than that. Really what it is you are... I'll just show you that. You go. You are essentially talking about a hierarchically structured document. This is the beginning of the document. There is an element, which is the top element, which is then split into element one, element two, and so on, and their attributes. Each of the elements can have their own hierarchical structure. If you decide not to use hierarchy and just go with, two levels, then you get normal relational databases. If you just have one level and say document, and the element is body, that's IR. And in between, you get databases as well as object-oriented databases as well as, text with this paragraph begin, paragraph end, section one begin, section one end. So that's our best idea for supporting specification of structure. Next class, when we come back, we'll look at what are the implications of this and whether or not there is meaning to these tags. And why are IR folks interested in this? I already mentioned to you, they want to be able to use this structure to say, for example, that, find the subtree where all the keywords appear closely together. Okay, that's what IR guys would do. Database guys also want to look at this as essentially a form of a relational database and support querying on that. Okay, we'll get to that next class.